Hour number two, Chase and Big Joe, 102.5, 106.3, the game on this Tuesday. In fact, Joe, it's a tail wagon Tuesday at First Horizon Park. We say hello to Jeff Hem, the voice of the Nashville Sounds, who has been nice enough to join us. Jeff, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Doing fantastic. It is a tail wagon Tuesday. I think that is a Tito's tail wagon Tuesday. You can bring your dog to the park. I think that's always fun.
Yeah, it's been going on for several years now, and it's grown. It started as like one day, I want to say 17 or 18, and popular. We did two dates the next year, and now for several years in a row, it's been every single Tuesday. And the cool part too is that every time we have one, it helps a local animal nonprofit, because there's the human ticket and there's the dog ticket, and all the dog ticket proceeds benefit an animal nonprofit every time we do it. So tonight, the beneficiary is Proverbs 12:10 Animal Rescue, and so I think we've got probably a dozen or so of these every year. And so there's, you know, a good 7-8 nonprofits that get helped with one date or two dates of these tail wagons. So that part of it is very cool.
That is cool. So be sure to check that out as the home stand against the Durham Bulls opens tonight. But, you know, I'm always curious, and we've had these conversations before, you know, with the Brewers leading the Central right now, you know, they're obviously doing well, and they're going to do everything they can to, you know, win that division and go far in the playoffs. So how does that affect the Sounds and kind of the balance of trying to have a competitive team at the AAA level, but knowing you're probably going to lose some guys to the majors?
Yeah, and we are affected by it every single day in one way or another. But I think in 9 times out of 10, the AAA team, even if it means you might have a loss or two here and there because you're dealt a little bit of a short hand because of call-ups, like 9 times out of 10, the storyline is still that it's wonderful. Like you're helping a big league team try to win a division, and you're getting guys to the big leagues. And that's what AAA ball is all about. So, you know, almost every day it feels like somebody's going up, and the Brewers, like you said, they're going to take whatever they need when they need it, whether it's somebody for a day or a week or for a few months now. And we've had no shortage of movement this year. I think the biggest impact it's had so far this year is on the pitching side, because the Brewers several times this year have had the AAA team manage the pitching staff in a certain way to keep, you know, this pitcher from throwing for a couple of days so that he's ready. And then you got to make sure you don't go too long without throwing. So you're always kind of threading that needle of like, hold off on this guy, we might need him, use this guy instead. And then after you use this guy, so like the pitching management becomes unique at times. Like you might go to a Sounds game and you see a starting pitcher throwing really well, and he only gives up, you know, a few hits and no runs, and he might come out after the fourth or fifth inning. And if you're in the stands, you think, well, why? That guy's dominating. Why would they take him out? Well, sometimes that's because the fewer pitches you throw, the sooner you can be ready for that next outing. And the Brewers are looking at it as like, hey, we might need that guy to be up here for his next outing. So that's where it becomes a little bit unique. You don't always see a guy just go 7 innings just because he's pitching well. Sometimes he's kept short despite how well he is doing. So I think this year so far, that's where it's shown up the most. We've seen plenty of different guys go up, but the pitching management has been a lot different because the Brewers want guys to be able to throw 2 or 3 innings if they're going to be a long reliever. Up there, they might be a starter down here, and so sometimes the starts get kept short down here in preparation for a possible need, and then it sometimes that need never happens, and no one ever knew it was going on behind the scenes, but that's how the Brewers have to try to manage this, and they're sitting pretty atop the National League Central, so everything they're doing, even if the Sounds are affected by it in a tougher effort to win a ball game at AAA that night, it's working, and they're going to keep doing it as they should.
We're talking to Jeff Hem, Nashville Sounds play-by-play announcer here on the Chase and Big Joe Show. Jeff, one of our topics today is random run-in with celebrities and just kind of odd and funny kind of moments. You've been around baseball quite a while. Has there been one incident or moment where you're like, holy cow, that's Tommy Lasorda, or holy cow, that's somebody that you grew up, you kind of idolize, and there they are? Because I think in your travels, you've done that many times.
Yeah, I mean, you know, along the way, you get to meet different people, or different people are at the ballpark that you weren't necessarily expecting when you go on the road. Every major league team has at least a handful of, you know, former guys of their own who might be a special assistant role, or they're coming in to do a meet and greet, or they're doing VIP appearances or something like that. Like I remember years ago meeting Ken Griffey Sr. When we were playing a Reds affiliate, because he was doing some things for the Reds, which makes perfect sense since he used to star for them. It's funny you mentioned Tommy Lasorda. I did get to meet Tommy Lasorda when I was working in single-A ball. He was doing some things for the Dodgers, and we were playing a Dodgers affiliate at the time, and there was Tommy Lasorda. I remember my first one, my very first year, I was an intern in Battle Creek, Michigan in 2004. They were the Battle Creek Yankees at the time. And down in the stands, you know, a few rows behind home plate with a radar gun, as I glanced down there one day, was Jerry Krause, the old Bulls general manager,
who had a
baseball background. And I later learned, like, he had a connection to the Yankees farm director. And this was in 04, you know, there's 6 years removed from that final last dance of the Bulls. And I'm like, there's Jerry Krause scouting a single-A baseball game, the architect of six NBA championships. I didn't meet him because I was on the air, and then he was gone because he was, you know, covering the game. But I just remember thinking, like, and, you know, that's my first year in the business. I'm like, hey, this is kind of unique. I'm seeing Jerry Krause at a ball game. Like, how random is that? So that one came to mind as soon as you asked the question, because I had no idea he had the baseball background that he did, and that he was still doing some like advisory scouting for the Yankees. So seeing Jerry Krause, especially for me as an Illinois guy growing up in the Chicago area, those 90s Bulls, man, that was my bread and butter. And then seeing Jerry Krause scouting a single-A baseball game in Battle Creek, Michigan was definitely a double-take moment for me.
I'm sure it was. You know, it's funny, Jeff, about 10, 12 years ago, I remember talking to Don Money, who was the manager of the Nashville Sounds, and he was so great. I was talking to him. He's like, you know what? I got the hardest job in baseball. I was like, you do? Tell me why. He's like, AAA manager, because half the guys think they belong in the big leagues, and the other half should be in rookie ball, and I got to balance that. And it always made me laugh. I told Rick Street about this, and we laughed as well. You've been around it quite a while, and that's a delicate balance that the manager in AAA has to do every single day.
Yeah, Rick talks about it often. You know, that he'll say the best part of his job is getting to tell somebody they're going to the big leagues, especially when it's their very first time and maybe they've had to grind for a little bit and weren't the first round pick. And, you know, those stories never get old. And so he just did it a couple of weeks ago with one of our relievers, James Meeker, who was 29 years old. He pitched in independent ball. Like, getting to tell James he was going to the big leagues, like, that's pretty cool for the AAA manager to get to share that news. And Rick will say, every time, you know, the minute after he tells the news to that player, his mind has to go to the three or four guys who were also in the mix for that call-up who didn't go up. And, yeah, they're happy for their teammate and they respect James, but, you know, they'd be lying if deep down they probably weren't thinking, like, I wish that were me. So, and the AAA manager's got to manage all that. And we got to manage the emotions and, you know, the confidence levels and the egos and just the mental part of this for anybody in that clubhouse who didn't go to the big leagues. And so that's where I think Don Money was right in that regard. Like, he's managing a bunch of guys who all want to be somewhere else, even if they love where they're at. I say this to people all the time, like, the Sounds, the players, they love Nashville. They love our ballpark. They love the fans, but you can't fault them for wanting to be somewhere else because they're that close to the big leagues. And when that carrot is dangled like that, you understand that their mind would love to be in their body, would love to be somewhere else the second you told them that there's a chance for that to happen.
You know, that's funny. Now, I forget the guy's name. This is 2007 or 8. Ryan Braun was on the team, and Prince Fielder just got called up. And I forget who it was. He was like four home runs away, Jeff, from being the Sounds all-time home run leader. And I was like, hey, how does that? And he pulled me aside, and he's like, hey, I don't mean to be a jerk. Don't ask me that question because it's a title I don't want. And I was
right.
Like, I get it. He's like, yeah, because I want to go to the big leagues. I was like, I understand it.
Yep. Yeah, nobody gets into professional baseball wanting to set AAA records. Even if, you know, like, even you know that guy would be on some level proud of that because that means he's doing some things at a hard level of baseball that are impressive, but
right,
it's not the ultimate goal. So, he could only be so excited to break something that's not, and it's coming at a place where ultimately he's not wanting to be.
Jeff Hem is with us, voice of the Nashville Sounds. They're back in action tonight at First Horizon Park with first pitch at 6:35. He'll have the pregame for you at 6:20 on 94.9 The Fan. So we've talked a lot about this and, you know, the rule changes, and a lot of those rule changes that we are now seeing in the big leagues started in AAA and below. And I think it has made the game much more enjoyable. It moves faster. There's more action. It seems like fans are really paying attention. But another thing that I think kind of went overlooked that they've done with AAA is how they've done the divisions. I mean, at First Horizon Park now, you got the AAA affiliate of the Cardinals coming to town, the Braves, the Reds, like all the teams, Cubs, that people love around here. How big has that been when it comes to attendance and people wanting to come to a ball game to see either, you know, players that may be on their back nine that have, you know, come back down, or players of the future?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I remember opening day last year, Louisville was in town. Joey Votto was on a Reds rehab assignment. Like, that's the opportunity for that to happen in our market is pretty cool, because if you polled Nashville, in my opinion, you'd get a lot of, like, what MLB team do they follow the most? You're going to get Braves, Reds, Cardinals, and then probably a mix of Cubs, Yankees, Red Sox, a mix of all kinds of other teams as people continue to move to this city from other parts. So I think in that regard, the realignment has been great. You know, I wish the schedule brought them to town more. Louisville only visited once. Gwinnett, the Braves affiliate, doesn't come here until our final homestand, which is also when Memphis comes here for only the second time. So I wish our schedule were a little heavier on some of those teams, but it is better. I mean, for years we'd be in the Pacific Coast League, like in the era that Joe was just talking about. And, you know, you look over to the other league and you're not only seeing parent clubs of teams that you wished the Sounds would play, like Braves and Reds, but you're also just seeing geographically some teams laid out in a way where you're like, well, they're only a few hours away. Why don't we play them? So, and now we have that, and it's much better. I wish the schedule format were different a little bit, and that's a soapbox for a different day. But I like the alignment geographically, and there's no doubt that, like, in an effort for the Sounds to truly want to have something for everybody at our ballpark, whether you're the diehard fan or you don't watch a pitch because you're in the bandbox or somewhere in between, if one of those things that might bring somebody out is that we're playing an affiliate that has a parent club that you like, we'd love that. We're hoping that someday the Worcester Red Sox will come to town and the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre Rail Riders will come to town. They're AAA for the Yankees. Like, A, for the novelty of it, and B, just because we know those teams have a large following. I mean, we've got Iowa coming to town in a couple of weeks. We see Cubs apparel in the park when we play Iowa. It's noticeable. Same way it is for the Reds and the Cardinals when we play Louisville and Memphis. So that part of it, I think, has been really cool these last few years in the realignment of putting the Sounds in the International League.
Yeah, and you mentioned the schedule and kind of how it shakes out. I find it interesting, the first week of July, you'll do three games at Memphis, and then they'll come here and do three games, which I think that's kind of cool.
Well, and the way they build the schedule is always they sort of start at July 3rd and July 4th, and then if you're picturing a horizontal line of the calendar, they work left and they work right. They work out from July 3rd and July 4th just so that every minor league team across the country can either be home on the 3rd or the 4th to do the fireworks and get the big crowd, and it's just huge for every team across the country in the minor leagues to have that opportunity. So this year, yeah, and then within that, they try to make it easier travel if at all possible. So to play Memphis is an easy bus ride after that game from being there on the 3rd and coming home on the 4th. So that part of it makes a lot of sense. And you know, Major League Baseball in this minor league takeover, so to speak, the last few years has had to learn a lot of things. One thing I know they knew right away is how critical it is for all the teams across the country to either get the 3rd or the 4th and not have to, you know, every other year get that homestand where you get the 4th of July, because everybody wants it. And so to have that is crucial. And that's really the starting point of the schedule. And then they build out from there to figure out homestands and road trips and all that. So that'll be good. And I can't believe it's already coming up here in a couple of weeks, the 4th of July. But, yeah, looking forward to that.
Crazy to think for sure, but appreciate it, my friend. Enjoy the series at home against Durham starting tonight. Pregame at 6:20, first pitch 6:35, and of course you can listen on 94.9 The Fan. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, guys. See you soon.
Absolutely. Jeff Him, voice of the Nashville Sounds, joining us here on the show, talking some baseball. Coming up next, I haven't even told you about this. I have a college football topic.
Oh, I like
you.
It.
And it was something that I've been saving because I knew we would have more time this week. But it was, I'll just set it up next. I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's going to get you excited.
You better.
All I had to do is say college football, right?
You've teased me with this. Yes.
That is for sure. It's the Chase and Big Joe Show presented by the Omni Nashville Hotel, 1025, 1063, The Game. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle. Chase and Big Joe, 102.5, 106.3, The Game here on this Tuesday. We're broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning, Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. All right, I didn't tell you what this was, and we'll get a few segments out of this.
Okay.
So ESPN Plus did an article a few days ago, and I've been saving this. College football's most influential teams ever. Ranking the top 30. So in the history of college football, these are the 30 teams they consider the most influential of all time.
The year of a team, Mike, the 19,
yes.
Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is Bill Connolly from ESPN. The greatest teams don't always make the greatest impact on the sport. However, for more than a century, college football's evolution has been driven by teams both big and small and by coaches both massively and only moderately successful. This list is an attempt to celebrate the influencers, both the Nick Sabans and the Mouse Davies, both the LSUs and the Gramblings. It's a list of the 30 most influential teams in college football history.
Oh, okay. This is good.
So you can make the list in a lot of different ways. Maybe you spurred a major innovation. Maybe your team came to define the peak of a certain era.
So it's not championship.
Correct.
Okay, good.
So like, for instance, the number 30 is a 12-0 team from 1899 and a founding member of the Southeastern Conference.
Sewanee.
Yes.
I love it.
They went 12-0. Billy Suter was the head coach.
Oh, Willie Suter. Love that guy. All right, let me start this. It's good.
Just name it. Name a team, and I'll tell you if it's on the list.
The 1986 Miami Hurricanes.
Okay, my guess is they are. Let's see. 86, Miami. Talk about yourselves.
How are we doing today?
They are the fourth. They're number four on the list.
Yeah.
11-1. Jimmy Johnson, of course, the head coach.
Well done. Let's go with
Is that when they became kind of known as the U?
Yeah. That's when they show up at the press conference and Fiesta Bowl, dress in camouflage, fatigues, and end up losing the game to Penn State when Pete Giftopoulos intercepted the ball in the end zone for Vinny Testaverde.
Yeah.
Who else? I'm going to go with the 1977 Alabama Crimson Tide. Was that the goal line stand from Barry Krause?
All right. Give me a second.
You got random Bama teams, throw them up there.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few Bama teams. Did you say what
77, maybe 78.
So the 17th on the list is 1971 Alabama.
Okay.
With Bear Bryant, they went 11-1. Number 18 is an interesting one, by the way.
Okay.
We'll get to that. Don't see 77 or 78.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Who's number one? Just let's start it that way. The number one most influential college football team of all time is, according to this poll,
do you have a guess?
Is 60? Is it Bama?
No.
Okay.
It's in the 60s, though. That is correct.
In the 60s, would it be, hold on, Ohio State?
Nope.
Ohio State. Was it Texas?
Texas. 1968 Texas Longhorns. Darryl Royal. They went 9-1-1.
Is that the tie game?
Yeah, so many college football innovations have started far outside the mainstream in places like Carlisle, Pennsylvania, or Mount Pleasant, Iowa. but one of the single most influential innovations of all time took place at one of college football's power schools. In essence, it doesn't sound like much of a tweak. Tasked with modernizing a stale offense, new coordinator Emory Bellard, who strangely enough had been hired as the linebackers coach a year earlier, basically went back in time to install the split T option offense as a way of getting more of a loaded backfield. There's more, but that's yeah, kind of how they look at this.
So Emory became the head coach at Mississippi State in the late 70s. Wow, okay. I like this. This is interesting. Who's number two?
Number two is the 1924 Notre Dame Fighting Irish. Was Newt Rockne.
Four horsemen on that team?
Yes, okay. Probably. Outlined against a blue and gray October sky, the four horsemen rode again.
It's a great, great line. I forget the writer who did that, but that was a great line.
Number three, I think you were about to reference this, was 1925 Alabama with Wallace Wade. They went 10-0.
10-0. Yeah.
Then number four I mentioned was Miami in 86.
Wow, that's the most current one, okay.
Number five is a fairly recent one. The 2008 Texas Tech team led by Mike Leach. They went 11-2. He's talking about Mummy going taking the air raid vision, and it basically it's the evolution of the air raid offense that Leach made. I think people don't realize that, like how influential he's been.
And he can't make he's not allowed to be in the College Football Hall of Fame. Did you see that? You have to have a 60% winning percentage. He's
really?
At 59.6.
Oh.
So all these Bob Stoops is very adamant, like round it up.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And put him in there. Who's the receiver for Texas Tech, the one that Richard
Crabtree
called out? He ain't nothing. Yeah, was on that team in 08. So.
Yeah, it says the peak came in 2008 with a four-star quarterback in Graham Harrell throwing to the best receiver in the country, Michael Crabtree. Tech began the season at 10-0 and moved to number two in the AP poll after a classic upset of top-ranked Texas. The Red Raiders lost two of their final three to slip to 12th, but this season provided a new level of proof of concept for the air raid offense. So many of its concepts have become part of the generic college football offense in the years that have followed, and that's an incredible thing to say considering its counterculture thinking and small-town start.
Absolutely it is. Okay, that's current. I keep going. So that was number six?
Yep. All right. I'll give you the rest of the top 10. Plus, there's one in the top 20 of a local that's a local influence.
Oh, I like this.
There's a local one.
Okay.
In the top 20. We'll do that next. Chasing Big Joe, 105, 106.3 The Game.
People talk about me, baby. Say I'm doing you wrong, doing you wrong.
Steve Miller Band. Chasing Big Joe, 102.5, 106.3 The Game on this Tuesday, on until noon today. Chasing Big Joe presented by the Omni Nashville Hotel. All right, most influential college football programs of all, or college football teams of all time. The top 30, this is from ESPN. So we did the top, I gave you the top five already. Number six kind of ties into what we were talking about with number five. The 1991 Iowa Wesleyan team, Hal Mumme, the head coach. After a couple of years, this is his version of the air raid. So it's like the evolution of the air raid offense.
Okay. That's a reach to me for that. Because you already explained at number five about Texas Tech and what they've done.
But he kind of got that from Hal Mumme.
Okay, but Mummy, you know, what did he do at Kentucky when he was there from 97, 98, and tried to run the wishbone with Billy Jack or whoever that guy was at quarterback at the time. Then he had Couch, took over after that. Interesting.
Yep. All right, number seven, I think they might be the best college football team of all time. 2019 LSU.
Oh, yeah.
At Orgeron. This is what it says. There was the actual innovation factor with a wide variety of RPO and pass concepts derived from both passing game coordinator Joe Brady's brain and the absurd array of receiving options available. Jamar Chase, Justin Jefferson, Terrace Marshall, and tight end Thaddeus Moss, running back Clyde Edwards-Helaire out of the backfield, LSU was able to both create and exploit matchup advantages instantly. And while RPOs are designed mostly to exploit zone defenses, LSU could beat man and zone equally well. There was the finally someone different factor. Clemson and Alabama had split the past four national titles and played each other in the college football playoff. All 4 years, there was a hunger for something new, and LSU provided it.
It was, and there's so much great talent team, but I think what gets overlooked, it just kind of thrown in there, is how good Joe Burrow was at delivering the football to everyone.
Yeah.
He was – you had Jefferson, you had, you know, Ja'Marr Chase. I mean, there was a lot of other players on that team, and Burrow kept them focused, man. Nobody was bigger than the team, and Burrow was fantastic in 2019. I'm not sure we'll ever see anything else like that.
Number eight on this list, I think, is a good one and one that, is definitely a historic team. 1967, Coach Eddie Robinson, Grambling State.
Probably should be in the top five.
Yep.
The impact he had on football. Remember, a lot of teams wouldn't play him. I mean, it was sad. Same with TSU. TSU would have beaten the snot out of so many teams had they were given the chance. And Big John Merritt was a legend, and so was Eddie Robinson. That's a shame. But, you know, I mean, he had so much good talent. When Doug Williams won the Super Bowl with the Redskins in 87, you know, Grambling quarterback, was great. So probably a top five team. He's a top probably three or four all-time coach.
I'll get to the local one in a second. Number nine, and I think this could be higher, 1993 Florida.
93?
Yep.
That's odd team to put out there. I was going to think
they were 11-2.
The 96 Florida team was really good. The national championship team.
Because that was Warfel, right?
Warfel was senior year. Yeah, they were good.
It says Alabama ruled the SEC for most of the 70s with otherworldly defense and dynamic run game. Georgia then ruled from 80 to 82 with defense and Herschel Walker. Mm-hmm. Auburn won 4 of 7 conference titles from 83 to 89 with defense and runners like Bo Jackson. Johnny Major's Tennessee team won in 90 with a 1,200-yard rusher, a top 15 defense, and just for grins, two ties. Alabama won both the SEC and national titles in 1992 by allowing 8.2 points per game and doing only what it had on offense. Florida won the SEC in 91 with Shane Matthews throwing for 3,100 yards. The Gators won again in 93 with Danny Werfel and Terry Dean throwing for a combined almost 4,000 yards. One of the SEC's best ever quarterbacks, Steve Spurrier, had Florida playing the way he wanted to play, not the way the SEC was accustomed to playing. He did it with more than a little sass, too. His 93 Gators beat number 5 Tennessee, thumped Alabama in the SEC championship game, then blew out unbeaten West Virginia in the Sugar Bowl to finish in the AP top 5 for the first of 6 times under the old ball coach. There was a whole different way of winning in the SEC.
Okay, I see it now. I mean, they won 4 straight SEC titles, but I mean, like, they had Kevin Carter on defense who was just dominating people like that. But it kind of got the ball rolling because, you know, these other teams was kind of stuck in their ways. Spurrier's like, we're going to throw the football, and that was what happened, and then roll through 4 straight titles.
Number 10 is the 1912 Carlisle team coached by Pop Warner. So –
what's the significance there besides having Pop Warner?
Well, listen to this. Coach Pop Warner, Captain Jim Thorpe, left tackle, future college football and pro football Hall of Famer Joe Guyon. Guyon?
Sure.
Guyon. All-time greats. A Sports Illustrated, Sally Jenkins called Carlisle the team that invented football. It was at Carlisle Indian Industrial School where Warner, the great football innovator, created the three-point stance, the single wing, and in 1912, the double wing. With Thorpe and a roster of limitless talent at his disposal, Warner let his imagination run wild.
Okay, that's not
bad. So kind of the birth of it. All right, now the local one that I said I was going to tell you. So I'll give you the others real quick leading up to it. 11, 1947 Notre Dame. 12, 2011 Alabama. 13, 1974 Barry Switzer's Oklahoma Sooners. 14, 1935 TCU. 15, 2007, Oregon. Because that's when.
What year?
2007. They went 9-4. Mike Bellotti was the head coach. But it said after going 21-3 in the 2001 season, in the 2000 and 01 seasons, Mike Bellotti's Ducks had averaged just 7.4 wins per season over the 5 years that followed. They needed a jolt of energy, an FCS product himself. Bilotti dipped into the FCF ranks to find it, bringing New Hampshire offensive coordinator Chip Kelly and his revolutionary spread offense across the country.
Wow.
So that was kind of the spread offense when that took off. 16, 1940 Stanford, 17, 1971 Alabama, and number 18, the only local one on the list.
1938 Vanderbilt.
Nope.
Is it Vanderbilt?
Nope.
Tennessee?
Nope.
Well, it's not really Sewanee. You already got them. Hold on. TSU. Oh, yes.
Yep. 1973. TSU.
Hell yeah.
Coach John Merritt, 10-0. Ed Too Tall Jones was selected first in the 74 draft. Linebacker Wayman Bryant went fourth. Receiver John Holland, linebacker Greg Kendall, and defensive tackle Carl Wafer went in the second. Big John Merritt might have been the single greatest recruiter in the HBCU universe, and even as SEC schools were finally integrating, something that would eventually drain the HBCU talent pool significantly, Merritt painted his masterpiece in the early 70s, overwhelming opponents and going a combined 40-2 from 1970 to 1973.
The man. He was great. I mean, then he had his coach's show with Hope Hines where he had not seen the tape until they rolled it the next day, and he would call out players on the air while smoking a 7-foot cigar in studio. And he was an absolute legend. I mean, the stories of John Merritt rolling up to practice in a Cadillac and smoking a cigar, I mean, those guys loved him. I mean, it was just such an iconic man.
Yeah, and obviously our friend Ricky is, I think it's his great-uncle. But they're obviously related.
They are related.
So there you go. Big John Merritt and Tennessee State on there.
Again, number one was?
I was going to tell you one more, and then let me scroll back now.
Sure.
19 was 1984 BYU, Lavelle Edwards.
Yeah,
those teams.
I mean, they won the national championship. Trevor Maddich is on that team.
And then number 20, 1999 Virginia Tech, Beamer Ball with Michael Vick.
I disagree with that.
No. You wouldn't have them on there?
No. As impactful,
it was pretty impactful.
Cultural changing teams? No, not them.
Number one.
No, the Texas. 67.
Yeah, 68.
Yeah, 68. Well, I mean, it's good. It what it does, it gets to a nice debate, a nice argument about who the most, you know, teams are that set the – did something to move the game forward in a different way and not a way of like – you know, 38 arrests and all the things that go on. Like, the Gators team under Urban Meyer would be talked about, but they were just so many bad apples on that team that you can't – even that documentary on Netflix was awful.
Hair Metal Henry says, let's not ignore the fact that Ricky Merritt has carried on that greatness.
He has. He sure, sure has.
Donovan and Franklin says 2001 Miami was better.
Better team, yes. Cultural impact, no.
Right. Patrick says, my dad grew up in Oklahoma, and the 1985 Oklahoma football team was his favorite. Bosworth was on that team. Keith Jackson and others love the show.
Yeah. I mean, that 85 team, Jamel Holloway, wishbone quarterback, Boz, all that went on with him, that was a hell of a team. And I think they won the national championship because Tennessee beat – Miami in the Orange Bowl, and Oklahoma went up and won.
Robert in Nashville says the 1971 Marshall Thundering Herd. Was that the plane crash?
Yeah.
And just what awful. That team did. 97 Nebraska.
Yeah, that's a good team.
So appreciate y'all weighing in on that.
Oh, we got one more. Our good friend Dan Phillips. 65 Michigan State on the list. Very first team to incorporate black players predominantly from the South. Helped break the color barrier in the South. Won the national championship in 65 and 66. Bubba Smith was on those teams. God,
yeah,
what a player. Thank you, Dano.
Yeah, that's a good one for sure. 615-737-1025. Again, on until noon today. We got Matt Jackson, Titans linebacker, joining us at 11 o'clock.
He's got a big football camp this weekend with the Hillsborough High Schools. We'll talk to the Titans linebacker coming up at 11 o'clock.
We will do that and much more. Chase and Big Joe, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Chase and Big Joe, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Tuesday edition on until noon today. 3 hours again enjoy the participation that we've had today with our question of the day, which is...
All right, so 40 years ago today, the movie Rhinestone premiered in Nashville with Dolly Parton and Sylvester Stallone. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about best, worst movie of all time. This truly was the worst movie of all time, just terrible. But we had the premiere here, and for those who went out there and saw it, it was something fun. Later that night, some folks ran into Stallone at a restaurant downtown, and just a random, odd celebrity encounter. And so our question today is, what's the random, oddest celebrity encounter you've ever had? I think the one right now, the leader in the clubhouse, is the guy who met Gary Busey in a bathroom. That's just...
So he followed up on that and said that they were filming Fire Down Below.
Oh, is that the Seagal movie?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because I forgot he was in that.
That's right, he was.
Yeah.
It's such a terrible movie.
I know. I knew somebody that was in that, too.
Oh, man.
This is a pretty good one. 2911 says Ron Jeremy at B&A, Nashville Airport.
Oh, what has he been in that we would recognize?
When he called the hedgehog? Dr. Crady, you ever heard of Ron Jeremy?
Can't say.
Good.
Good. Google him, but not at work.
No. Just moving on. Just moving on with that one. Oh, man.
Let's see. Viking Matt says, ran into Eric Davis randomly at a TGI Fridays in L.A. Chatted with him for about 30 minutes during happy hour.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's cool.
That's Eric Davis. Man. Eric Davis, by the way, that had a birthday, turned like 60. We had him on the show, the birthdays. Yeah. He turned 63. He was like, Eric Davis is that old? He's an amazing baseball player.
He also says, and Chase doesn't stink. I've ran into him more than once at Bridgestone at some 102.9 and 102.5 remotes.
Who said that you did?
Thank you, Viking.
I just asked Wayne how you smelled.
I don't know. 8657, 1978 family trip to San Diego. We were staying in the same hotel as the Reds. As we were checking out, I walked past Johnny Bench. Tom Seaver saw George Foster and King. Good King Lord, Griffey. Your voice to text did not work here. King Griffey. Yeah. Okay, that's who we saw. I saw the Reds. I can't decipher this.
I had coffee one time. I went to the Braves Cubs games in Atlanta with Jody Davis and Keith Moreland. And people won't remember. They're Cubs icons back then, and they were at the hotel. And I was like, holy cow, that's Jody Davis and Keith Moreland.
Oh, well. Andy says, my son's a rookie firefighter, so at a restaurant he spotted Aaron Kinney of the Titans, a volunteer firefighter. He came out and lit his red truck up with lights and sirens. Such a good guy.
Where's he now? He's a fire chief somewhere.
I think so. I don't know.
Up north.
I have his number. We should get him on. That'd be fun. Yep. Let's see. I'm sorry. I'm trying
it's
to.
Okay.
Michael Madison. I was working at the Opry back in 2019, taking orders at the concession stand like normal. And all of a sudden, Chris Jericho comes up in line next. Super awesome and very friendly. Got his picture after I realized it was him. I walked out when there was a Preds game and AEW was in town a few years ago. And I was walking out of the arena like I'd worked the game, and here comes Tony Khan, Chris Jericho, and some of the others, and I just was like, let's go, Jericho, and he turns around and like high fives me and goes, thanks, bud. Like, it was cool.
Is he still popular now?
Oh yeah. Yeah, with music and with wrestling.
He does AEW, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so that was the only time I've like met him, if you want to call it that. But I interviewed him one time, and it was early in my career, and so I was kind of geeking out a little bit and got him on the phone, and I was like, you know, I've really been looking forward to this, and he just goes, I've been looking forward to talking to you. Like, and that just chilled me out.
Oh, that's
made
very
it so cool.
Cool.
Mike wants to call in and give a celebrity run in. Mike, what's up?
Hey, guys. So two quick ones. Chase, on the wrestling front, I used to be able to have the opportunity of providing the catering for when the NXT shows used to play the War Memorial downtown.
Yeah.
And I got to have a 30-minute conversation with Samoa Joe and Finn Balor about getting put through a table. It was pretty entertaining. One of the guys offered to ask if I wanted to get put through a table. It was pretty entertaining. The second one, my dad, when I was younger, spotted Frank Wycheck getting a haircut next to the Publix in Franklin, And he sent me in there with a little Titans mini helmet to bug him during a haircut. Horrible thing to do, but he did it for me. He was real nice. Fast forward just a little bit, and we were seeing Britney Spears at the Starwood Amphitheater, front row. That's Britney Spears before she was crazy with my girl. And who was sitting right next to me? Frank Wycheck. And he noticed me and goes, "You got an autograph for me in the haircut the other day." Nice.
That's awesome.
So, I mean, ever since then, Frank's always been one of my favorite players. And, man, just rest in peace.
Yeah, very good call. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks,
appreciate
Mike.
It.
Thanks.
So I mentioned Loveless and, like, people that would come in.
Yeah.
So when they moved here, like, pretty quick, I think it was Tuesday, the day off, usually, Frank Wycheck and Al Del Greco would come into Loveless. And so they got to know my grandmother and all that stuff. And she was always very good about, you know, like, if a celebrity came in, now she'd get them to sign a picture to hang on the wall because they had the Wall of Fame. But anything else, you know, that she wouldn't ask for unless it was for me. And so one Christmas, it was the first year, 99, I open up presents and I pull out a Wycheck jersey and a Del Greco jersey, and they're both signed.
Nice. Still got them?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
I should bring them in here and hang them up, man.
Nope. I don't share those. But, yeah, so that was pretty cool. Frankie was always the best. Tony or Troy says met Daryl Strawberry at IHOP in Vero Beach during Dodgers spring training.
Oh man, what a redemption story he's got going on. That's great.
Joey from Bellevue. I haven't, but I know someone that met Jason Statham in Hawaii at a bar or restaurant. He was filming Hobbs and Shaw. The guy I know didn't know who he was, but his girlfriend told him. Man. Jason Statham would be cool to meet.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a iconic kind of action actor to do that. Yeah. How'd you not recognize him?
Tom in Nashville, at a movie premiere in New York City with my wife. She was at the bar at the party arguing with the bartender along with another woman. My wife comes back from the bar, asked her what the issue was. She said her and Laura Bacall didn't like the vodka selection.
That's fantastic. Oh, yes. Lauren Bacall. Oh, that's good. There's a guy in town that has a typewriter store. He has old vintage typewriters, and he's in one day, and a guy walks in looking around. He's like, "Hey, let me know if you need any help." And he's like, "Yeah, sure, whatever." Like 20 minutes later, the guy's like, "Hey, tell me about this typewriter here." And he walks and he's like, "You're Tom Hanks." It's up in Goodlettsville. And there was a big story in the paper about, like, Tom Hanks.
Well, because Rita Wilson, I mean, they're here all the time.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
And that's very cool.
Because Rita Wilson's got her music career, so...
How's that going, by the way?
I don't know. But, I mean, I know that I've heard from a lot of people that they've randomly spotted Tom Hanks in Nashville.
Oh, that's cool.
And that he's been super nice.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Forrest Gump.
He's one of those guys now that he hit it so big. Because you think about some of the big movies he had that, like, you hit one of those, you're set.
Yeah.
That he's basically like, I'll do a movie every couple of years, and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, that's – and, you know, kind of pick what's good and what's bad. And
like, if he doesn't like the script, he doesn't have to do it.
You know the movie Big?
Yep.
Right, which is fantastic.
Wasn't supposed to be him.
Who was it?
It was supposed to be Al Pacino,
no.
Right?
No. Close. Who's next Al Pacino? You think about?
De Niro. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
I knew it was somebody like
came
that.
In, yep. Tried to change
didn't
the movie.
Didn't they film like half the movie?
Yeah, and Penny Marshall's like, "Yeah, this isn't working. Take care. Yeah. See you around." Yeah.
It's amazing, like, the what almost was
true
stories. Like, you know who was supposed to be Indiana Jones?
Tom Selleck.
Yep. And you know why he couldn't?
He was doing Magnum P.I. And you gotta hit me with Tom Selleck trivia.
Belisario wouldn't let him out. Was like, "No, you can't miss. You got a contract."
Yeah. It's one where he was going to win either way.
Yeah. And look, Harrison, I mean, now Harrison Ford.
Right.
And because Lucas knew him from Star Wars, right. Obviously. So
one of my favorites is that Stallone, Beverly Hills Cop, was written for Stallone.
Yeah.
Like the Eddie Murphy, that was for Stallone, the whole thing. So Stallone went in and changed everything. And they're like, "Nah." So Stallone said, "All right." And he went and made Cobra. So Cobra was offshoot of what Stallone. So,
yeah,
because Stallone
didn't want to do the funny thing.
There you go, man.
We'll get back to this in hour number 3, 615-737-1025. But coming up next, Titans linebacker Matt Jackson will tell you what he is up to in his camp. Also, Vince Ferrara talking Vols at the bottom of the hour. Chase and Big Joe, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.